the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you love.
Hello and welcome to this Thursday, September 15th, 2011 Education Now radio podcast. I am your host, Athena Melville. Tonight we welcome the return of Dr. Margot Porter. Margot was a guest on Education Now in November of 2007, and it was a great pleasure to talk with her again about the current situation in our public schools and in teacher credentialing programs. Margot is an educator with over 30 years' experience serving elementary students and teacher credentialing candidates in Northern California. She counts over 4,000 elementary students and 250 credentialed students that she has directly instructed. Her interest in student learning and classroom studies guides her work, and she holds a master's degree in curriculum and instruction and a doctorate in instructional leadership. Her dissertation research examines teacher beliefs regarding mandated curriculum. A strong student and teacher advocate, she is currently a professional development teacher working to translate instructional directives into effective classroom practice. She grew up in Nevada and moved to California, where she began her professional career. Margot Porter cannot remember a time when school was not a part of her life. The downside of an educational life is a world scheduled around school holidays and bell schedules, and deeply affect eating habits and restroom breaks. The upside is a world of intrinsically rewarding learning, spending time with the spontaneity and honesty of children, and proximity to like-minded peers. Margot is living a life of quiet nonconformity. She claims few awards. Valued honors come with the reciprocated kindness and engaged offerings found in classrooms and learning. And that's what Margot had to say about her bio. So without any further ado, I bring you Professor Dr. Margot Porter. Hello, Margot Porter, and welcome to the radio waves of Education Now.
Hello, Athena.
It's really good to have you back. I have told our listeners in the intro to this interview on Education Now about your background, and that you've had over 30 years' experience serving elementary students and teacher credentialing candidates here in Northern California, and that you have a doctorate in instructional leadership. And so they've been introduced, and I did also tell them in the intro that you've been a guest before on Education Now, and I'm just so delighted to have you back.
No, it's good to be asked back.
I can tell you from students that you have had that I know how highly recommended you are, and so it's wonderful to be able to talk about topics in education, especially public education today, with someone with your experience and the kind of respect that you command from others. The research that I've done suggests that standardized testing is having a negative effect on the learning process, and I was wondering if you could tell us how you feel about testing.
Well, the thing about testing is that the testing itself isn't really evil. And certainly in my years, I've put students through PACES with weekly spelling tests and projects. I think it's the purpose of the testing that is creating the problem right now in education. There's a real damage that is coming from the misuse of test results and the emphasis on improving those results. And this is what we are in the midst of experiencing now. I think that the current emphasis that is set by non-teachers, by the way, is to raise test scores. And no matter how they spin it and try to make it about learning, it's really about the scores and getting them higher. The scores are basically running the show. And it's being driven in a typical bureaucratic manner from the top down. And the target, which is like really like a militaristic target, is the classroom. So the impact hitting the classroom is hitting where the really important stuff happens in education, and it's bearing the brunt of all of this.
So it's not the testing or the tool, it's the way that it's being used.
That's pretty much my take on it, because testing has been something that we've all participated in, and in fact, in different ways, perhaps not paper and pencil, but in looking to see if our instruction has been effective, we are setting projects or assignments to see if the students are really using and have retained any of the instruction that we've given them and put it into a learning practice mode. So testing isn't a bad thing. It really helps me know, as a teacher, where I'm going and what to do next.
And I understand. And do you find that your assessment of a student before they're tested usually is the same, you know, or are you often surprised?
Hopefully I'm very surprised at the after. When you start out, basically, you're picturing what students need, and you get to know your students, and your planning goes. My planning goes from there, and we do things. Basically different forms of instruction happen, and then we have, as teachers, we need to know where we're going next, and that would be an assessment of some sort that would hopefully surprise me with, yahoo, we hit it, they got it right.
So that let's see, if we're communicating, if you didn't have a test, but you had to rely on your experience with a student to decide where to go next, do you find that you make that assessment before you give the student a test? And then, if you do that, are you usually surprised, or do you usually have a pretty good assessment without the test of that student and where that student should go next? Or do you feel that the tool is essential for helping you make that assessment?
Well, if we're talking about standardized testing,
uh-huh.
It is not particularly informative to me as a teacher. Standardized test results are delayed. Typically, I get them after I no longer have those students. There's just a whole batch of problems with the fact that the standardized tests that are given in the spring of each year are basically not particularly useful in my future planning.
Right.
They tell me what I haven't accomplished or what my students haven't retained after the fact. And the really depressing thing after the fact is that there's not a whole lot I can do about it. It's the typical bureaucratic kind of view of things, which is after the fact, and doesn't help me at all.
In the process, yeah.
In the process or what's to come ahead.
Okay, I understand. Now, well, how do you feel about teachers' jobs being linked to their students' test scores?
You know, I wouldn't mind this at all if teaching had the same kinds of design that manufacturing bottle caps has. You know, I really don't understand or support the idea of learning or students being products that are somehow manipulated or processed or fashioned in some way to turn out at a certain level of quality. It's sort of an analogy kind of planning thing that it's just lost on me. So getting me back to the, you know, if they could guarantee me that my class would come in at a level, everybody, and that they would learn the same way, and that they would, and that they would, you know, all meet the same level, point of learning at the same time, and that when they finish, you know, if they could guarantee me this kind of a class, then linking my job to it would be fine with me. But we all know that isn't when you're dealing with people, that isn't what you have.
No,
at all.
That isn't.
Nor would I really want a class like that because it would be sort of like it would be like a Stepford classroom. it wouldn't have a whole lot of life to it.
Yes.
So I don't really think that's something I would aspire to, although it seems to be the picture that we're sometimes driven to because of all of the requirements that are put on us in the classroom level. So,
yeah. This whole thing is just infuriates me. The thing is, when a doctor gets a patient, and that patient perhaps has cancer of some kind, that doctor isn't, his salary doesn't depend on whether or not that person lives or dies. You know, that's not how the judgment is made on the quality of doctor that he is. And I don't see how that's any different with the teaching profession. I also feel that these people who are making these suggestions and who may very well be able to apply these outrageous rules to teaching should have to pass a test to prove that they could pass a science test. Can they pass a history test? I mean, if they're going to be making the rules for teachers, then they certainly should be able to pass a test. It is just so infuriating to me.
So, well, it's sort of like, you know, the Michael Moore movie where he was all about recruiting the congressman's children to serve in Iraq. It was like, okay, if it's good enough for everybody else, it's good enough for you. Why aren't you doing this? And, you know, to expect that these people would really know enough about the job that has to be done to actually participate in the practice of it is beyond me. There's an idealism there that is just, there's no touch of reality in it whatsoever. One of the things that bothers me a lot is the fact that we know that when students come to us in the classroom, that they come with a lot of potential always. I mean, I do believe everyone learns. But they also come with a lot of really serious problems and often damage, and we are stopped short in talking about that piece of this learning puzzle because everybody the the big people are telling us that that's just an excuse. Get over it. But we know that when students come into the classroom and there are family problems, or the kids are hungry, or their brother has cancer and is dying, we know all of these things are real for them. And we also know that there's no way that I'm going to be able to successfully have them participate in a drill on multiplication facts and have them retain anything, because it just isn't going to happen. You know, there are a lot of our students who are on survival mode, and that's part of their life, and that's what they bring to the classroom. And, you know, we have to deal with that as we try to create a learning environment for them. And that certainly is a good guess at that point that this particular student isn't going to make a high test score this year.
Right. That's the thing is that another thing that's so infuriating with me with all of this national discussion going on in education is that there is no looking at child growth and development, which, you know, tells you and you learn that unless a child's needs are met, they cannot come. You know, they cannot absorb, they cannot move on. Those needs need to be met. So to expect to say, get over it, to a teacher is such an insult. It is an insult to the children, and it is an insult to the entire profession of social service. And it's just maddening to me. This total disrespect for science is just maddening.
Well, it's heartbreaking, because the point where teachers come from is a real dedication and commitment to students. Students are the first and most important part of this job that we have.
Right.
And we're very protective of them, and to have their really essential survival needs, that they're not met is one story, and the other one is for me to deny that those exist.
Right.
Is making me say less of them, and that just doesn't set well with most of us.
This culture, our nation has been in such a state of denial in so many respects, and this is just another glaring example. Well, do you feel that the disrespect that we're seeing for the teaching profession will affect the quality of the potential teachers that you'll get in the credentialing programs?
Well, that is kind of, it's hard to say, because my experience in the credential program has been the opposite. In the last decade, I have seen some of the best teachers I've ever met coming through the system. And I think that is because they have already determined a goal for themselves that will make their lives more what they want them to be, a dedication of reaching a goal of serving others, it's hard to explain that commitment and that mission that comes from teachers' hearts when they make that sudden choice. Sudden to others, or to themselves usually, that others see as, you know, why are you doing this? And it's like, this is what I need to do.
Right.
It's pretty deep and it's pretty strong. So I do see that. What bothers me, well, there's a lot of things that bother me, because I sometimes see these same people being, they drop out early in the career. Whether, you know, it's disillusionment, it's not being able to to do the job that they see that needs to be done. Politics are very heavy and hard to maneuver through. So we lose a lot of really good people within the first few years because they just cannot go on and choose to do other things. And that of course is, like, to me, one of the saddest things of all.
Right.
They have more opportunities than way back when I started, which was long ago, so it seems. They have options that we didn't have in the past. And I mean, what is there to attract people, and especially young people, to this profession? I mean, the salaries are ridiculous, compared especially to the amount of schooling that you will get, that you have to have before you actually even just get a job, and the cost of that education, and, you know, the amount of student loans that you're going to be paying out of this little meager salary that really isn't going to go anywhere because, you know, funding isn't there. Salaries is the last thing that will get any increase. It's a pretty dismal, bleak thing when you look at the realities of it.
Right. And even if you go into it with a sense of mission and, you know, you say, I don't care about the money and I don't care what I owe, but I want to do this. I want to really make a difference in children's lives because they're the future. And then you find that you cannot practice what you learned as best practices in your training because of the politics in the system.
Well, and very often it feels like you are causing damage when the intent is to never cause damage, you know, do no harm kind of thing. And
right.
Sometimes the requirements of the job seem like, at least to me, there were instances when I felt that, you know, I'm having to do this, and this is harmful, and this is not okay. Those moments when I question why am I here and why do I stay here, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it gets pretty emotional, very
yeah,
emotional.
Yeah, I would think so.
The thing about the the disrespect, though, and it's kind of curious to me, is that when I'm in a group of people who are not teachers and they're talking education, which they try not to do around me, but. It's always like they have to stop and say, now we're not talking about you. You know, it's like, okay, who are you talking about? Oh, those people in New York are far, far away.
It reminds me of a time in history with a civil rights movement, and people would say, oh, don't get me wrong, I have friends who are black. Or, I have friends who are Mexican, or I have friends who are gay. You know, it was not really with the way they approach it belays that they don't really understand and that they don't, and that it's sad. But.
Well, it is sad, and truly, most people I know, if you ask them about, you know, who is one of the most, besides your family or parents, who is the most important person in your life, they will almost always name a teacher.
That's right.
You know, so
that's right.
It's like, there's a reverence there. It's just like it's the popular in thing to do.
Right.
It's just bash a teacher or bash the system. Or,
right.
Well, if venting helps, fine, but it doesn't really help me, so, yeah.
My mentor, Joy Turner, who I dedicated education to, she had showed us some research about how that even with all of this testing, that the best indicator to how a child will do, not only in school, but in life, is a teacher's recommendation. Even though that is thought to be so subjective, when you look at the statistics and that is the best indicator of how well a child will do. in school and in life is a teacher's recommendation. So there are those people who know that because they know when a teacher has touched them, it stays with them for the rest of their lives. And yet, you know, I can't help but wonder with these people out there who are dishing out this disrespect and this bullying of teachers. You know, while we're having this anti-bullying campaign and this anti-abuse, and then now it's time to bully and abuse the teachers, it's so sick. It's just so, so sick.
Yeah, well, what's the connection here? Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to say that, you know, teachers make remarkable differences in young people's lives in ways that we really have no idea how this is going to happen or what
right.
You know, I don't know. Students will come back. One of the joys of living in an area for so long is I get to re-meet these students often when they've brought their own children into my classroom.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. And the things that they remember, it's like, oh, wow, yeah, okay, I'd forgotten that part, or, you know. And it's like, none of this has to do with learning multiplication or writing cursive or any of those things that right now are the things that are being valued. And I just think, well, thank goodness I've gotten it right so often, because if these are the things you remember, goodness, how many things could you remember that wouldn't be so positive?
Right. Well, when you're educating the whole child, and then that's what you're remembering, and they know, children know when they're being valued for who they are, when they're being treated as subjects and not objects. And since parents are our first teachers, you know, that's why it's so important that parents learn these skills even if they don't go into it professionally. It's not that we didn't know, but somehow all of that got lost in our culture, which is sad. And so it's sort of a learning process for parents as well. And a lot of preschools I know have a program within them where the parent is taking classes at the same time that the child is enrolled in the preschool, so that the parent is brought up to speed on what's essential for that developing child. And so it's sort of an extension. Teaching is an extension of the family. That's the way that I look at it. And
part of me is grateful that such programs exist, and part of me is sort of appalled that they even have to exist.
Yes.
The saddest lesson I learned very early on in my career was that not all parents love their children.
I know.
And it was like, how can this be? And I'm looking at this marvelous human being here, and you really don't like him, do you? And it was sad, the saddest thing of all.
Oh, it is sad.
Because, you know, my students, rascals that they have often been, you know, I just love them.
I know
for,
you do.
For exactly what they were, rascals or not.
Right.
And those rascals, my goodness, some of them are doctors now.
I know.
Whoa, okay.
And, you know, sometimes when you meet the rascals, at least I noticed from my time working with children, is a lot of times those rascals really, that's the way that they survive that not being loved, that not being understood, wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And those who aren't wanted and aren't loved and can't and don't and aren't rascals, those are the ones I really worry about.
Right.
But anyway. Right. Well, so can parents, if a parent wants to opt out of testing, the standardized testing in California public schools. Can they do that? Can they do that, Margot?
Okay, I'm a teacher, and I'm employed under educational laws for the state of California. And so, surprisingly, I have restrictions on what I can do with this topic. So what I suggest to your listeners is that if they're interested in this, they should Google it, and I recommend that they go to the California State Department of Education site at www.cde.ca.gov.
Yes.
And when they reach that, they should type in the little search box at the top. Doesn't matter what page they're on, just the search box. Type in StarRegs, S-T-A-R-R-E-G-S, 0207, D-O-N, and these are all lowercase. And this brings up the state testing regulations. And then if they go to Section 852 in the document, they will find information.
Okay. So let's go through those steps again. They should actually, they could just Google the California California Department of Education. And once they get there, once they get to this website for the California Department of Education, California State Department of Education, they should go, is there a topic like standardized testing?
No. Those will just turn them into total complete circles. That's why you have to go to the search box.
Go to the search box once you're there.
And then type in STAR regs, all lowercase, STARREGS.
Yes.
0207 CLN.
CLN. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, Margo, could you email me that information so that I can put it, so that I can be sure that I repeat it properly in the outro?
Oh, no problem.
Thank you.
Basically, the short answer to the question is that parents always have options. And the option for this is not easy to find. So as you're going in the circle and going and next and next, that is very typical. There are things in regulations that are difficult to find, and parents do have rights and choices.
Okay, thank you. I know we run the gamut between those that don't care and those that really do care, and even in that situation, sometimes you really have to question: are you caring because you can't let go, or are you caring because you're really trying to protect the child from something that is harmful? And that can be difficult to.
It is. And ultimately, though, this is the dilemma all parents have all the time.
Right. You have to deal with all the time.
Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot more options out there than we know. They're just options for parents are often, and teachers even, they're not easy to find sometimes. You just keep looking.
You keep searching. You keep doing the research. Well, now I'm going to move on to another topic and ask you what your feelings are regarding the teachers' unions. Is that something you can talk about?
I can talk about it, sure. yes. I kind of, when I'm thinking about teachers' unions, I think about Howard Zinn. He did so much work studying the story of unions in history. And basically, no matter how you feel about unions one way or the other, they create a story that really demands attention. And so that's kind of where I am with unions. I have a love-hate relationship with them, and I have had for my entire career. And one of the things that I'm not sure the public knows is that, belonging to a union is not really an option. It's what would be called a closed shop. If you want the job, you join the union. So every teacher in the state of California belongs to a union, and that's just the way it is.
So it works in the public system.
Right, in the public system, right. If you work for the state, then you basically are a union member. So the thing about unions is that it's politics, and so it's like any politics. There are some things that I agree with and some things I don't. And even though their agenda is supposed to be in my best interest, I sometimes question that and feel like I haven't had a voice in creating their agenda. But then I have to remember that there is a voice, and that in education, in educational history, that hasn't always been true, and that teachers have been typically oppressed by not having a voice or a say. So I have to say, in many ways, it's a good thing just that they're there.
Oh, I agree. I agree. I really do feel, I really support, people being able to get together and collectively bargain. I think that's really important, and I always have felt that way. But I just question how they've been working, and how they could work in a better way for teachers. I did hear Dr. Stephen Krashen talk about the unions in March of this year, and he was saying that they just haven't really been there for the teachers and the students during this defamation of character and this standardized testing frenzy. That you could tell it was bothersome to him that things were getting so out of hand without the unions having stepped in and, done something, taken some kind of an action. For me, the standardized testing seems like a contradiction to best practices. Not because I disagree with testing, but the amount of testing, and that they're planning on doing more testing, and that they're planning on testing in kindergartners, and that the unions aren't, now the unions are speaking out, now that they're attacking unions, just the ability to gather and speak with one voice, that is being attacked. But why this fight didn't start earlier? Why this compromise? That's what's curious to me, and what's frustrating. I really don't ever want to lose the unions. I think they're so important, but I really think that they could be doing somehow a better job, and I just don't know. I heard people say, well, people need to be more involved in them, and then they would be better. But I mean, you elect people to represent you.
Right.
Isn't that?
Yeah. Well, the issue with the unions, and especially in regards to testing, is that I don't really think they have a whole lot of say. And what I mean by that is that prior to NCLB, I would have said, sure, yeah, if this had been happening. But NCLB mandated, it legislated testing. And it tied that testing with funding for the schools in all the states.
And then it was never funded.
Well, they didn't have to fund it. They tied it to funding that had nothing to do with education. But this is the story I've been told, and it was a good source, that actually there were other funding things attached to that that had nothing to do with education, so that the states would be more receptive to accepting the terms of NCLB. And politically, I can understand that this kind of stuff happens. So when it becomes a law, a federal law, and it's passed to the state level, there's really not a whole lot of negotiating that the teachers union can do in terms of the law.
So the teachers union couldn't have gone to the ACLU and said, the Bush administration, through No Child Left Behind, is asking us to do something that all of the experts in child growth and development are telling us are hurtful to the child, and they're mandating that we should have to do it.
See, I'm not certain that didn't happen.
I mean, it's kind of like saying, well, if the state mandates that we can hurt your children, we can hurt your
children.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Exactly. I mean, that's a very simple view, because we now really understand all of the ramifications of all of this endless testing that, 10, 11 years ago, that wasn't out there. We suspected it, but we didn't have scientific proof that
right.
we have now.
Right.
But I really think that the union has restrictions on what kind of, how much influence they have in situations like this. And I do believe that there have been lawsuits and all kinds of legal things going on to slow down things. And they haven't been particularly successful. And not being involved in the union heavily, I really don't know specific instances of that. But I kind of see that the union has been nibbling around the edges a lot. I know that there is a plan at this point to have second grade excluded from the yearly tests. And that's basically under the reasoning that you just gave, that it's inappropriate developmentally and all of that. So that, and I do believe that is doing well and almost to a completion where maybe this coming year we actually won't be testing second graders.
Well, what?
It's not a lot, but it's a step.
It is a step. It is a step. In doing this research up, a friend dug up, which I thought was incredibly interesting, McGraw-Hill, which is one of the publishers that does a lot of the tests, and, of course, a lot of the textbooks, too,
mm-hmm.
and which is another, I have a big contention with these textbooks. I just read recently where the California agreed to modify their textbooks in terms of plastic and bent to the will of the industry to change their textbooks so that students wouldn't feel like plastic was that bad. Now that's just infuriating. I mean the integrity of teaching, that you can as a teacher decide what you're going to teach. I mean, that's your whole, that's the whole point of it in a free society. And so that just drives me crazy. And then, of course, that the textbooks, they don't really tell the people's history. And that you have access through the computer to all of the sources of information. It makes me even wonder why we need these textbooks. But, you know, if a teacher wants them, fine. But a teacher should be able to choose the textbooks they want. They shouldn't be all just ordered in big batches and said, these are the textbooks that we're using. It's just so creepy.
I'm just sitting here smiling from ear to ear and nodding my head. It's like, of course, it's all nonsense. But the system is so, I don't know, what's the word, bureaucratic, that it just sort of like feeds on itself. You know, we not only have to have textbooks in our rooms, or teachers do, they have to be adopted through this incredibly complex process that basically takes out all the good stuff that textbooks could have and now don't. And they're supposed to be looking for biases like plastic, whatever you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
One would hope that that would have been stopped at some level.
No, they agreed to it. They agreed to change it. To change a textbook so that the kids wouldn't get the idea that plastic was that bad, even though the entire Pacific Ocean is being clogged to death with plastic and this really fine plastic dust. I mean, it drove me crazy to read it even, Margo.
Well, one of the things that I did last spring in my credential class for social studies, I was doing a blended class. Blended means half the classes are online and half are in a classroom.
Uh-huh.
And I determined that the online classes should definitely be something different than a classroom session. It makes sense, right?
Right.
So I gathered together my famous source of YouTube. I gathered together several videos from YouTube about a textbook adoption process that had gone on a year or so ago in a social studies curriculum, and learned a whole lot about textbook adoptions that my students were like, you've got to be kidding me, this doesn't even make sense. And it's like, well, yeah. You know,
uh-huh.
They were little things like renaming the Civil War. They were including the people they wanted and excluding people that they didn't feel were important. You know,
right.
Some people, like, you know, Pocahontas was definitely not important, so we can get that name out of there. It was a real eye-opener for me when I thought of doing this and started doing the research. And then when I presented it and the students actually got involved with it, it was like, this is a good thing I just did here, because they have no concept
yes.
of where the materials come from that land in their room. And they really had no idea of how much they needed to question the contents of those books. That it takes an educator to really handle materials well.
Yes, yes.
And crazy things happen and crazy things get put in there. And, you know, as in the Texas situation, you know,
yes.
having a dentist determine what's the correct history to go into this textbook is a little bit too much for me.
Oh, yeah. Way too much for me. Way too much for me. Well, the thing I was with the McGraw-Hill is what I found out is that the McGraw-Hill are very best friends with the Bush family, and they funded Bush Sr.'s presidency, they funded GW's presidency, they funded Reagan, they're going to fund Romney. And, you know, that kind of a connection, I mean, that is a conflict of interest. You know, where are the lawyers? Where is the Justice Department? Where is the justice for the education system? Where is the freedom, you know, to teach for a teacher?
Well, this connection has been well known for a long time, you know, for a decade at least.
Yeah.
That, you know, and, you know, all I can say is if I had invested any of my not extra money into testing companies, that would have been the one to go with. And that was just a no-brainer because we all knew where they were going to land.
Right.
And it is big money, make no doubt about it.
Oh, I know.
Part of the reason that these standardized tests are so invasive and I mean, it's money. It's a huge, huge amount of money.
Right, it's a gold mine for these people.
It is.
And it's just going and the way that they've decided that they're going to add more and more and more of them, is just going to continue to feed them. All of this money that should be going into the arts for the children, to a lower student student-faculty ratio, to the teachers, to extracurricular activity, to creating beautiful environments, is going to these pigs. It's just so sad.
It definitely.
What is the class size like in California public schools today? What's the ratio like?
Well, the ratio is all over the board, so it just sort of depends on where you live.
I see.
There were a couple of years ago special funding promises to schools that if you kept your class sizes at certain levels, that you would get more ADA per student, and it was enough that it enticed most of California to have K-3 classes at 20. And I think made a huge difference. And with the economic change last year, they took away the funding, and so districts took away the class sizes, and we had kindergartens with 29 kids in them.
Isn't that so sad?
Anybody who's never been in a kindergarten class, much less a kindergarten class of 29 students, it's not a pretty thing.
No, it isn't. I mean, we have known for so long, since the 60s, that if you go over 1 to 17, you retention drops by 70%. So in most classes, they would try to have, I mean, back in the days when California was second only to New York and this fabulous system, which is why I moved to California, frankly, they would normally have two teachers or a teacher and an aide in a class of 24. And, which was a 1-to-12 ratio, just beautiful, And they've just decimated. They've just decimated our system. And when they keep saying, well, what should we do and how should we do it? I keep going and say, well, we know how to do it. Leave us alone and let us do it.
Well, I think that what really discourages me is that, I grew up with the research that you are talking about. And I was reading recently on one of my education sites where the new research is saying that the size of the class makes no difference.
But who did that research? I would like to see that research.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I'm still searching for the actual research.
Yeah, I want to see that.
Because what happens is that somebody does something. Maybe they don't do anything. We don't really know. And then they throw it out in the public arena and then, suddenly its research says it doesn't matter.
Right.
And so that's picked up by our California legislature and by all of the people who just make decisions about class size.
And they don't have to
really know why, other than, oh, we can save a little money by getting rid of one or two teachers because we'll just spread the kids, around to these other people. So my discouragement is that the research claims, which make no sense to me whatsoever, are somewhere in studies that are not proving easy to get a hold of. So I don't really know, but I do know that the outcome statements of these things are certainly being thrown around and used to support decisions that are being made.
There are living models like New Zealand. you know, that prove that the class size makes a difference and individualized instruction and the pay of the teacher and not using testing. And so we have these models. We have these models that exist not only in the private sector but out there in the world that just, you know, are diametrically opposed to this supposed research that they have. Mm-hmm. So and so that they can't, that they don't have to present it before they can call what an expert in child growth and development and an expert in education says, that they don't have to produce that evidence so that it can be scrutinized, is also just maddening and proves that something is wrong, that we don't have to, you know, there's something wrong when the unions, when we're not keeping the child in the center.
Right.
There's something wrong. Well,
it's definitely our issue that the child has sort of been forgotten, unless it's taking the test.
Yeah, unless it's taking the test. Well, what are your feelings regarding charter schools, Margot?
this is like a two-era question. You know, having been in education for a long time, I remember when they started charter schools, and I was the original anti-charter critic. I was kind of appalled, actually, in the beginning with the idea of charter schools because at that time, public schools were underfunded, and I felt like it was a loss of funding to where I lived and worked, and going out there somewhere to who knows who or where, to places that weren't really being held to standards like public schools were. And it took me a long time to put public and charter in the same sentence because they really didn't feel like they belonged together. And I also felt like, you know, there was a lot of money involved in that, and that startup charter schools at the time were getting a ton of money, and it was sort of like anybody and everybody came out and started applying to have charter schools. And I felt like, and who's going to oversee this, and who's going to see that, you know, you have credentialed teachers and that you have learning actually happening in the classrooms, and that, you know, that there are actually classrooms there. That there were some situations in the beginning where there weren't even classrooms, and the children were actually just the family. It was a charter school of a family kind of thing. So yeah, I was definitely on the anti-charter school side. But I have to say that over time I have found some very, very dedicated charter schools that are doing really, really good jobs with the students and the learning, and actually are not that far away from public schools in my sense of a good public school, but they're doing a good job, and actually getting to know some of the people in charter schools has made a huge difference, that I can see these things and my perspective has gotten wider, and I do honor the genuine, true charter schools and the teachers that work there that are really using the concept of charter schools to further education.
Yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying. I feel the same way. My understanding is that in California, a charter school is a public school, and that you have to have a California credentialed teacher teaching the class. That teacher has to have a California teacher credential. Now they may also have a Montessori credential or a Waldorf credential, or you know, some other pedagogy bias or that they're using or a philosophy, but they have to have a California teaching credential. That was my understanding. And so I was supportive. But then I found out through research that some of these charter schools were being started by, they had California teaching credentials, but they also had a Christian bias and a Christian fundamentalist bias. And so essentially, it was public funds going to a school that didn't believe in the separation of church and state. And that really upsets me. I don't understand why that is happening. Do you have any problem with that, with the public funds being used in a school that has a particular religious bias?
Well, there's two parts to this. The idea of any kind of faith studies in public schools. I'm pretty hardcore on the fact that, you know, there's a difference, and if you want your children to have some kind of religious education, that's fine, but don't expect it to happen in a public school where everybody has differences, and we're not really teaching anybody's faith. And so how these got into the charter school system is really beyond me. It's inappropriate. I'm guessing that there are loopholes in there that have allowed this, and those loopholes need to close because it's not appropriate in terms of funding. You know, religious-based schools are private schools, and they should be. And you know, if you have a public school, you get public funds, and if you're a private school, you get private funds.
Right.
And it's just basic vocabulary.
Right. Now they're even talking about giving vouchers of, you know, public funds to private schools, like Catholic schools. And, you know, so you could take your child to the Catholic school or to the fundamentalist Christian school and use your voucher. And I'm like, oh, no, no. Now, I really like, I know in Modesto, they have, instead of, you know, that all of the kids, they study all of the different religions as a class. And so then all of the children then are not, and cultures and mythology and psychology. I love that idea, where you're learning about other people's religions and you're telling about yours and you're sharing cultures. And, oh, that's to me just sounds wonderful. And, you know, cause all of that diversity. So I'm not one of those people that just, I'm an atheist and a public school should be as for atheists. I'm not like that. But I do feel like the diversity needs to be a part of it, or else they should not get public funds. And then I'm glad to hear it sounds like you feel the same way. I don't know how you feel about the schools in Modesto that are letting all of them have a voice.
Well, there's a big difference in a rather academic, instructional study of diverse cultures.
Yes.
And the instruction in a particular faith or religion. They're two different things. Right. And I would guess that this kind of diversity experience wouldn't be happening in any of these religious charter schools.
No.
And from my point of view, that just sort of is in the face of respect and honor of people's differences that it's not acceptable.
Yeah.
It's not acceptable at all.
How do you feel about these chain charter schools that like Gates and and other there are other there are other corporations who are starting chain charter schools, you know, where they specifically focus on achievement and drill for the tests, or, you know, they have huge classrooms, like Gates is talking about having huge classrooms and having a lot of it be you know, computer. And I love using the computer, but the idea of having, you know, 600 kids sitting in front of a computer instead of having teachers, you know.
Well, I mean, I kind of think that that was done in the 60s when they invented teaching machines. They weren't exactly as nifty as computers, but, you know, it was the same idea that we wouldn't need teachers and whatever. And it didn't work out so well. So I think he's got an expensive model that it could have been done in the 60s if it wasn't in. And maybe he needs to do a review of the literature for the last.
Yes, he did. You know, it's so ludicrous. In history, is going to show that the administration for public education was listening to a man because he had money over the experts that their own educational system trained and, you know, nurtured. It boggles my mind.
Well, I'm glad that the man has a lot of money, because he is spending it, and he will continue to spend it. Everything that I've seen about going into these kinds of business charters, whatever, they go into it with a business frame of mind, thinking that we're going to do this and spend X amount of money, and we will turn a profit at some point. And that's just not going to happen, because education has never turned a profit, nor is it intended to turn a profit.
No.
Service does not usually get a profit of money anyway.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know, does Edison exist anymore? They were one of the first people who jumped in, and they were taking over schools and privatizing all the services and this and that, and we'll save money, and suddenly they were gone because they were losing too much money. You know, it boggles my mind that that they can come in with so much chutzpah, and then they're just like, oh, okay, not working, and disappear. The thing that's bothering me the most now, Tina, though, is not so much that kind of charter school, but internet charter schools.
Yes.
And I think that somebody has feels, because they no longer have to have a facility, there's a huge money savings there. And with everything done online, there's really no cost other than for somebody to put it online and, you know, make responses and monitor whatever is being done. And I have a lot of issues with these kinds of companies going in as charter schools. And there are just everywhere I turn, I see here's one more new one, here's one more new one. And they're getting attention, especially with teenagers. It seems to be like the alternative of choice to go to one of these. I don't know how they're going to work out in the long run, but, man, I just have great concerns, you know.
I do, too. I wonder if the reason that teenagers are flocking to them is because... before she died, Joy had told me that these big high schools are so alienating at a time in a child's life when they really need, you know, to feel that camaraderie and that closeness, and that they're so alienating. So you put that, you lay that on top of all of the stress to perform, and so then the suicide rates skyrocket And so this might be what some students are choosing. I know that there's the Khan Academy. He does math. And I have seen him on TED Talks. And, you know, what he talks about is using his media, using his math videos in conjunction with your class. So that, you know, but not that it would replace a small class where then the kids who understood it would be telling the other kids, and, you know. And it's just like we were talking about the tool of assessment. You know, teachers trusted when they said yes to testing, and then look what they've done. Well, if we say yes to this computer into the classroom and to getting lessons from the computer, will it be used to assist or to take over?
I'm not really worried about it taking over personally, because I just have such a belief that teachers are irreplaceable. Uh-huh. And that's just, I believe that so strongly that I guess I can't even consider any other kind of a world.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting that you brought up the Khan Academy, because it was a couple of weeks ago I was in a teacher's room, and she was so excited, and she has a web page that she puts up so her parents and students can access everything that they need. And when she puts up her homework assignment, the math assignment, that Khan Academy immediately inserts a link to, like, if she was doing decimals, and so there was a link that they could click on, and so the students could see how this particular procedure works in math.
Yes.
Clean, clear, to the point.
Yes.
Right there, without any effort whatsoever.
Yes.
That is, to me, the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
Yes.
Where technology is doing the job it needs to do.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And the teacher was so, like, this is so easy. I had no idea it was this easy. She said, and it's doing everything that needs to be there for the kids when they're not at school with someone to help them, and their parents can't do math. It's right there.
Yes.
And she has 26 students, and 21 of them were all signed up online, and the others did not have computers at that point, and she wasn't sure how that was going to work. So here's a great example of something working together.
Right.
I see a lot of the charter schools in Northern California, the online charters, under the reasoning being that, you know, we have a lot of rural people that live far, far from school. And I guess if my choice was to live, you know, so that my child had a four-hour round trip, bus trip to school every day, that maybe I would be tempted. But I have to question, you know, where's the socialization?
Yes.
And where's the person who's going to notice the student who needs the extra help but can't say, I need help? You know, how many times do you just in passing by, you know, walking next to a table and you see something that needs some help there, and it's a personal touch kind of thing, and
right.
Or something happens in the classroom, and suddenly there's this great teachable moment that you didn't know was going to happen, and you use it. And so many of those things that I treasure are not on technology.
Right.
I struggle with that.
Yeah, I understand. I know that I mentor families who are homeschooling, and if they make that choice, and one of the things that you know, we make sure that there is that socialization, that there is, you know, that the child is not isolated,
mm-hmm.
that the parent is totally conscious of this child growth and development and all on all of those issues. Because it's true that some parents use homeschooling to hide rather than it's a choice that they're making because they just do not want to subject their children to what they see is harmful. I took my children out of public school in 1980 when the whole system went into a business model from my perspective. And, you know, we saw it happen and we saw what was happening. Well, I was not willing to have my children in that situation. And I realize that the argument is, well, people have said to me, well, you took those kids who had their needs met and ready to learn out of a classroom situation where they could have then been a model for the other kids. And my thing was, well, they only had one childhood. I chose to have them and give them the best life possible, which is why I moved to California. And if that education system let me down, I was not going to let my children down. So, you know, I homeschooled them, and then other people asked if they could join. And so then it developed into a private school. But still, I understand, because I do understand why a parent may choose to homeschool, I choose to do this. But I really believe strongly in public education. I really want public education to be everything that it promised to be. And I know that there are people in the system like you, not just in the public school system, but in the credentialing system process that are so fantastic that, you know, I'm just grateful that you exist. But I do understand, but I understand how the Khan Academy we were talking about, when you hear Khan himself talk about it, he is talking about it the way you're talking about your teacher that you've met is using it. But when Bill Gates talks about it, that's not the way he talks about it. He talks about using it with a huge number of students in a big classroom situation where they're all sitting there at their computers. It's a totally different use of the technology. And, long story short. Anyway, so I understand why some parents would want to, if they're homeschooling, want to use it. And I do think that it is their right to homeschool. But I do feel that some people use homeschooling to hide, and some people use homeschooling because they really want their children to give their children the best of all possible worlds, and they don't feel that they can do that by using the public schools in their area.
A lot to be said there, you know.
Yeah.
I have to suspect that, I don't know if it's Mr. Khan, Dr. Khan, he must be a teacher.
Yeah, he's an engineer. He was worked for in the Wall Street kind of thing.
Hmm.
And then his nephew asked him for help in math, but they lived far apart. So he made videos for his nephew. And his nephew said, "You're better on video than you are in person." And so then he was letting his friends see the videos. Well, then that just developed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he felt like he could just do this. You know, it was fun for him to do, and that's how it took off. So he was an entrepreneur, I guess. Yeah.
And hope he's sharing with his nephew.
And he was really good in math.
Well, yeah, amazing.
In the 30 years that you've been working in the classroom, how have things changed? And do you think they've changed for the better? Or?
I think for the most part, other than all of the things that we've just been talking about,
yeah.
There have been a lot of changes anyway, period. you know, the first textbooks that I used were easy for me to use because I was a student when those textbooks were first used. So I was just teaching what I had learned out of. And they weren't very good textbooks either time. So the materials are newer. I'm not saying they're better, but they are newer. And we didn't have a lot, besides maybe some books, we didn't have a lot of anything else to work with. So we were always out scrounging materials or creating manipulatives or for math, or we were always, like spending our weekends like on craft project kind of things for school so that the kids would be able to do these hands-on activities.
And refine their small motor refinement and all of the things that experiential hands-on learning teaches you. I know from having you on before that your classroom is just fantastic, and teachers I know who have visited that classroom just raved about the quality of that classroom and the quality in of you as a teacher, Margot.
They're very nice people. But I always have felt that students need to be able to hold and handle things and look at them. And there was a time in education when we didn't have those things available, even buying them. I do believe Montessori was the only place that sold anything that was like hands-on.
Right.
And they were very nice, and of course we had no money, so
right.
That was never a go. Other changes, well, the technology has definitely changed. I lived in the beginning with typewriters and ditto machines and chalk.
Mm-hmm.
Chalk. overhead projectors came in. We thought we had just gone to heaven.
Right.
There was so much more we could do with those. I remember taking classes on how to thread a movie projector,
mm-hmm.
base movie projectors and film loops and reel-to-reel tapes and all of that. And I have to say, technology has made a lot of the visual parts and auditory parts of our lives much, much easier. But we didn't have frameworks, and we didn't have standards, and so we didn't get to do a lot of the things. A lot of the things that we did do were not really as effective as they could have been. So we had a lot of fun, but part of me feels that sometimes we just really weren't doing all of the things that could have been done. So yeah, those were changes. The students. I was trying to decide if students have changed over time. And overall, I guess they have. But I'm thinking my experience of them in the classroom is that they haven't changed a lot. They're still kids. They still like to learn, and they feel good when they learn something new. They don't... where students might try to text each other, they used to always write notes, so that's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I really wouldn't say my students or the students over time have changed a lot. I think maybe they're a little bit smarter, or at least come to school a little more prepared than in the past.
And how many students do you normally have in your classroom?
I ended with 20. but I have taught in classrooms up to 40 in middle schools and like that.
Right. So. I remember that was another remarkable thing that was reported to me about you, was that you were able to really have a packed classroom and be incredibly successful, which is no small achievement. Well, Margot, when we wind down here, Could you please tell the listeners how they can help public school teachers and students during this time in our nation's public school history?
Well, there's a few thoughts. First, I would say that people need to be informed. And, I mean, you know, read, listen, join the conversations about education. It not only makes you knowledgeable, but it really starts making you get at those internal thinkings that you have. I mean, really, truly, how many people, even beyond the classroom, and we need people beyond the classroom, really know how they're feeling personally about these issues. And people who do know how they feel personally, they need to be able to fit it into a bigger picture and see, so if I get what I personally want, is this going to have an effect on the system, and what would it be like if everybody had this kind of thing? Be informed. I would say also be thoughtful.
Be informed, asking, be thoughtful.
Being thoughtful, asking questions, but ask those questions of people who are really have the power to make some decisions, or the people who are really responsible to provide those answers. Many people ask me questions I cannot answer because these are things about decisions that I was not a part of, or things that there really isn't a choice about. And as we talked before, when someone says, the research says, pin people down, you know, say, whose research? Where can I get a copy of that? And when you do get it, read it and be critical. You know, don't be, anybody can read academic research. Just don't be taken in by the fact that somebody uses words that are misused because they're big. And you know, don't let numbers be a stopper, because numbers are just numbers. And they have to compute. And let's see if did your numbers work. Because people lie with numbers all the time.
Yes, they do.
I would say, last of all, to be present. Visit schools and shadow teachers and students. But also participate. Don't just stop at being there. You know, advocate for teachers and students beyond volunteering. Like, be a part of the system that might have an influence, like join PTA or site councils or attend board meetings, vote, write letters, ask more questions, and if you're really, really, really brave, think about running for the school board.
Aha! Oh, that's great. So be involved, be engaged, and be thoughtful.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful, wonderful advice. Oh, I thank you so much for this time, Margo. Is there anything you'd like to say before we say goodbye?
When I was thinking about, you know, the idea of what can people do, I was remembering something that happened to me a few years ago when I had the opportunity to hear Jonathan Kozol at Sonoma State speak. And everybody was invited to, you know, write down a question and, you know, you would like to have him answer.
I love him. He's one of my heroes.
Well, of course. I was so thrilled. And so I wrote down this question, and lo and behold, they read it, and he was standing there to answer my question. And I was so, like, thinking, I can hardly wait to hear the really supportive words, you know, that I've done the right thing and that, you know, the question was about subversive work of classroom teachers in basically not following the rules. And he was very thoughtful in his answer. And he ended it with two sentences, one a statement and one a question, that really made me rethink a lot of things. He said, life is short. What are you waiting for?
Yes, he's so right on.
He was so right on. And after I thought, you know, what?
Yeah.
It was like, yeah, he is right. Yeah. We need to take the actions that we are capable of taking.
He was at the march in D.C. July 30th, and I heard his keynote, and he's just so upset and so tired of waiting for Congress to take action on all of the research and work that he's done all these years, and to see this backsliding happening. And he just lambasted testing. But what he said at the end was, "I will never give up on this. I have given it my life, and I will never give up." And I was just very moved. Yeah. And we shall never give up. I can't see you giving up, Margo.
Doesn't appear.
Well, I'll say goodbye then. Thank you again so very, very much for your time, for taking your time to speak with me today and with the listeners of Education Now. And thank you just for being who you are.
Well, thank you. And I enjoyed talking about schools and learning and education all the time, so it was not a big effort for me.
Well, we'll have to do it again. I just love it that you have humor.
That's how I make it through.
Bye now.
Bye.
Well, I had such a wonderful time talking to Dr. Margo Porter, and about all of these issues in education. We covered a great deal, and it was a long and rewarding interview, at least from my perspective. The test options information that Margo mentioned for California, the web address there is, it's www.cde.ca.gov. And she said, in the search box, type in STARREGS 0207 CLN. And this will bring up the state testing regulations. Go to section 852 in the document. So once again, if you want test options information for California, it's www.cde.ca.gov, and then in the search box, type in STARREGS 0207 CLN. This will bring up the state testing regulations, and go to section 852 in the document. So as promised, that information was repeated. And if you didn't still get it, you can always send me an email at hermes@pacific.net, and I would be happy to send you the information. If you would like to contact Margo Porter, please send email to me here at hermes@pacific.net, and we will see that she gets her your comments. Margo and I referred to Howard Zinn and Jonathan Kozol in our discussion and dialogue. Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. Education Now podcasts are listed on the American Montessori website at www.amshq.org, and look in the local events section. That's www.amshq.org, local events section at the American Montessori website. If you could not join us for the Education Now launch, remember that you can listen and download free anytime at the website. Our next Education Now radio podcast will be Thursday, October 6th. Sending much cosmic love to you all. This is Athena Melville,
saying goodbye for now.
You are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you love.